Now have you turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Ecclesiastes chapter 11. I promise that we will finish looking at biblical perspective on economics, and we're going to finish it up today, and maybe have some time for some questions, some hard questions if you have for me. And then the next 2 weeks, we're actually going to look at transhumanism, posthumanism, and that follows quite nicely on what we're looking at in terms of biblical economics, understanding how God has made us to live in this world and to interact in this world, and then to look at what some of the power brokers, if you will, of our day would like us to how act and behave in the world in which we live, and to see that stark contrast as they reject Genesis 1, 2 and 3, and reject the lordship of Christ overall, and want us to live in a world really of complete tyranny. And so we'll see that the next 2 weeks. And then we'll have a break for the summer, and Lord willing, be back in September. But I'm just going to read these first six verses of Ecclesiastes 11. We'll pick up at this right at the end. These are wonderful words to remind us how to live in the world, how to approach life with its risks, with its ups and downs, but ultimately being able to put our faith and trust in our Lord God and in Jesus Christ. Solomon says, "Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to seven or even to eight, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where that tree falls, there it will lie. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. As you do not know the way the spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. In the morning, sow your seed, and at evening, withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good." And we'll come back to that a little bit later. So over the last couple of weeks, this is actually, I guess, the fourth session looking at biblical perspective on economics within our study of the doctrine of man. We began by looking at some of the key presuppositions, the foundational points of Christian economics, or the view of the Christian worldview and how we are to approach the world in which we live. And the big point there is, of course, we have to start with God. You really can't have a proper economics if you don't start with the Creator God and understand why we're here and who placed us here and an understanding of the created order and sin and all of these things. How can you possibly understand economics and how individuals are to do commerce and to work amongst themselves? And so Christianity starts with the triune God over all things. And we also said that work itself was pre-fall. And that's very important that we were put on this earth to work because we reflect God, who is a worker, and God is always busy. And always about the business of being God and being sovereign and being the ruler over all things. But we also said that because of sin, you know, work has become frustrating. And because of that, the natural condition of our world is not wealth and abundance, which it would have been in Eden. It's one of poverty. And unless you work, you're going to starve or you're going to live in poverty. And we talked about that. That the biblical understanding is that we have to work, we have to keep busy, and we have to struggle against the impact and the effect of sin on the creation. And we said that the Bible supports, really, if you're looking at economic perspective, is overcoming poverty, producing so that we can honor God, love our neighbors, and provide for our families. And this whole stewardship function of work is something that glorifies God. And, of course, it has to be done in a manner consistent with his ethics and morality, his character. And so we looked at that. We also just stated that there's at least 10, if you're looking at economic systems and thinking about a system that would be as biblical as possible, I said that there'd be at least 10 preconditions that you'd want to see in that system of economics. And I'm just going to give you these 10 quickly, and just again, I'm just giving you a quick recap so that we can then zip right into the last section here. Private property is essential, and as we looked at, the Bible supports private property from beginning to end. In fact, only biblical Christianity supports the whole notion of private property, starting with our own beings and being responsible for who we are as individuals, and the state not having control over what we even put in our bodies, which is a very relevant topic if we were to spend time on that today, especially over after the last couple of years when government's been demanding what goes into our own bodies. But private property, personal freedom, capital allocation decisions are in the hands of the masses and not the state, the government. Rule of law. The Bible from beginning to end emphasizes a rule of law and, of course, God's law. And you can't read the Bible without understanding the importance of the rule of law. Specialization of labor. Economies should always be those that allow people to take advantage of their gifts and abilities that God has given to diverse gifts and abilities. We see this right at the beginning and right after the Garden of Eden. You see the specialization of labor. And we see the gifting of certain craftsmen that God gifts when they're building the tabernacle and the temple and so forth. We could spend all today going through that whole line of thought. And there's, again, we see it even the gifts in the church. There's gifts, there's elders, there's deacons, there's pastors, ministers, and so forth. The world is just filled with diversity of gifts and abilities. And any system that's going to be prosperous and allow human flourishing will allow people freedom to work in different areas. Low barriers of trade and commerce. Access to the earth's resources. We'll get back to that today a little bit. The government's not there to stop us from having dominion and stewardship over the resources of the earth. That would be a good message in Ottawa right now. Low levels of taxation. That Christians know full well that you don't centralize power in the hands of few. This is a recipe for tyranny. And so you always have to starve the state with as little taxes as possible. A virtuous and moral population rooted in the Christian scriptures. And then lastly, a biblical family structure must be celebrated and promoted. Any society or culture that thinks you can run an economy by busting up the Christian family is deluded, right? You will see the destruction of that economy. It's the bulwark. It starts with the family unit as God has created, male and female. Lifelong relationship, raising children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. If you don't have that in the culture, you're going to have serious problems very quickly. We certainly see that in our culture. We looked at some different economic models, and of course they're all disastrous as you go through them if they don't allow these things to thrive. And we came and we said that basically the system that would be most consistent with a Christian view of man, of sin, of reality, and God would be a free market system. Again, when I use those terms, I'm talking free market, of course, with the idea that it's governed by people, you know, in ethical and moral standards that would be consistent with the scriptures. And the Bible supports this. And what we've seen over the last couple hundred years in the Western world, which has been heavily influenced by Judeo-Christian values and Christianity, is the thriving of a free market system, particularly in the Anglosphere, and then it's developed out from there. And that's as a result of the Reformation. Northern Europe, if you want to look at Northern Europe versus Southern Europe, you've got the Reformation, Protestantism versus Catholicism. You want to look at North America, and you want to look at South America, it divides on basically a heavy Protestant Christianity and a Catholicism. If you want to look at poverty in India and other places around the world, you're going to see Hinduism. You're going to see Islam in other countries. It does not produce vibrant, thriving, flourishing economies and dynamic growth. And this, of course, is why we see in our days this attack on free markets, you know, capitalism, if you will. It's not that Christians are here to focus on capitalism per se, but we want freedom to be able to worship God and to be able to work and to do what we need to do without interference, and that lends itself, again, to a free market system. And we looked at a number of areas that talked about this that I'm just going to skip over quickly. I just wanted to say that in view of warming up. And I also just mentioned right at the end that there is a number of freedoms that we take for granted, but are also very biblical, you know, biblically based. And I listed these off, and I'll do that once more. And again, all of these are defendable within a biblical framework and biblical understanding. And freedom to own property, freedom to buy and sell, freedom to and to move and travel and transport goods within a nation, freedom to trade with other countries, freedom to start a business and work in any job, freedom from excessive government regulations, freedom from demand for bribes, which are, the Bible has a lot to say about bribes, as you know, and that's a miscarriage of justice. It's a misallocation of capital. It's rewarding inefficient, dishonest people, and that costs everybody. It's stealing. It's theft. Freedom for employers to hire and fire and pay employees what they negotiate and what they merit. State has no right getting involved in the amount of pay that people are earning. It should be a free market system. It should be competitive. Freedom to access the earth's resources and freedom to access information and be educated. And then lastly, freedom of religion, conscience, expression, assembly, and association. These are things that, again, are all biblically supported and come out of a Christian worldview. So the Bible has a lot to say about how we are to live in the world, basically. And so you can see that in a day in which is rejected a Christian worldview and wants increasing tyranny, they wants to get rid of all of these different freedoms and just chops away at them one by one. So let's just shift over quickly into sort of action points and sort of look at what's going on in our own day in terms of some of this. And some people have said, okay, well, you know, how do you go about being a good investor or putting capital aside? How should a Christian think about some of the basic investment principles? And I'm only giving you here basic principles that you think about. I'm in the investment business. This is not meant to be an investment pitch or something like that at all. So I caution you. But to think biblically about, okay, you're in this world, you have surplus, how are we to allocate capital wisely and prudently in regards to what God has blessed us with? So let me just go over a couple of points that I think are important. I mean, first of all, I think that we should focus our investments. We should not over-diversify as Christians. We need to understand where we are investing. This is one of the fundamental rules of investing today, is you just spread your money everywhere. And we'll come back to that issue and how that's working against us in a little bit. But just go everywhere, because basically diversification is protection against ignorance, right? If you don't really know what you're doing, you just basically throw your money everywhere. Well, as Christians, we actually should take time to know what we're doing. And if you don't know what you're doing, you should find people who do know what they're doing and consistent with Christian principles, right? And not rather than just spreading your money everywhere, which has a whole bunch of danger associated with it, which I'll mention later. Second, you should look for, when you're looking at investing, because remember what we're talking about here is providing capital, your savings, into the most efficient places in the economy where we're going to see the production of goods and services that we want and we believe are redeeming value to our culture. We're going to see those done in an efficient manner, not wasteful manner. So you want to reward businesses that are competitive, that do a good job with the capital. They don't squander it like the government, which is one reason why you don't want a lot of money going to the government, because the government is the biggest squander and waster of capital that there is, as we all know. And so, again, you need to focus your attention. The next point is to say you should look for growth opportunities, growth industries. And we should focus and say, okay, what industries are expanding? Where are there opportunities out in the marketplace? As Christians, we should seize on those opportunities, again, if they are honest and ethical areas to invest. And we're looking at areas where we see real progress in the economy. Let's put some money in there. Let's get behind some of these businesses. Let's find good people in those industries that can expand. And so we look for growth industries. You should also, as I already pointed out, you should only invest where you understand and you don't speculate or gamble. This is something that a lot of people will say, well, you're in the stock market, and they'll say, how can you be in the stock market as a Christian? It's just a place of gambling. Well, it's how you approach the market. Yeah, if you are just tossing money into stuff you don't understand and you're in and out of day trading, that's gambling. That's not investing. And so, yes, that could be using the markets in an improper way. But as Christians, we should be thinking longer term, and we should be allocating capital wisely into areas where we're going to see products and services that we think are going to be great developments and innovations that are going to help mankind, love our neighbor, and then allocate money there and stay there. Put money behind good people and good ideas. and follow that through when we are investing. And so even private businesses. I mean, many of us I know have here talked to people that have money in private companies. I've got money in a whole host of private companies. And so, again, you follow people, you get behind them, and you try to see if you can't be a supportive of different industries. And I think that's great as a Christian. Most of these people, again, are Christians or very honest, ethical people, and they're building things that are really going to be of high value to our economy. Well, that's a great way to use capital. And we should think in those ways. Don't let just the world make money and focus on these things and then become billionaires and then turn it against the church, right? We should be good investors and wise with our capital. Or, as I say, find people who can do that too, if it's something that you don't want to get interested in. We need to also be very disciplined in what you pay for investments. You know, Warren Buffett says, wait for the fat pitch. In other words, be patient. So when you see a real estate market that's just gone straight up, like we saw the last 2 years, don't go chasing it. Not a wise thing to do. And so you want to be very careful about just following trends. Don't get your advice from the Uber driver, okay? Yeah, you get the proverbial, when the taxi guy's talking about it, it's usually not a good idea. You should be very careful. We need to be very circumspect of what we pay. We need to be parsimonious. We need to be frugal. We need to be like that old joke that I've heard. They said, the Scotsman, you can tell Scotsman's very frugal, and that's because how did the limbo come into existence? How did the limbo come into existence? And they said it was a Scotsman trying to get into a pay toilet. So you can see that you should be very frugal, though. The point is, as Christians, we don't want to be wasteful with our money, right? And so just don't follow trends and jump into things. Be careful about when you're investing. And then a couple other points. Hold your investments. Be careful about tax implications. We live in a highly taxed environment. The best way to compound wealth is to defer taxes and to compound on a deferred basis. This is a very important concept when you're getting taxed at 25% capital gains. And again, Christians should be thinking longer term anyway. We should be allocating taxes, our capital longer term. I'll give you one quick example of the pernicious effect of taxation when you're trading. If you have a dollar, you start with a dollar, and you double that 20 times. So that's 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, right? You double 20 times. After 20 doubles, you have $1 million. So don't let your kids get you to double their allowance 20 times. You're going to be in trouble, right? And like Little Abner, that was a Little Abner example. But if you pay tax at the end of 20 doubles, you give up 25%, you're at about $750,000. If after every time you double, you paid tax, and you let 25% of your gain disappear every time, you'd end up with less than $70,000. So again, this is just being prudent when you're in a high tax environment. If you can buy things that you can stay and hold and compound on a tax-deferred basis, more powerful. That's one reason why the TFSA is a very good investment vehicle for everybody to use in terms of the Canadian situation. And then I think you should also think about investing in multi-jurisdictions. Don't just have all your money sitting in Canada. We learned that in February 14th on Valentine's Day, the Day of Love, when our Prime Minister yanked the handle down and pulled the Emergency Act on us, right? And so I think any citizen should always have some of their money outside of the country that they reside in that could step on them very quickly in the day in which we live, if that's possible. And so just a few pointers when you're thinking about allocating capital. Now, I want to just talk a little bit about some of the economic challenges that we face right now in Canada, United States, in the world. And all of these challenges as a result of deviating from God's plan. These are all issues that have come up as a result of rejecting God's rule, if you will, in terms of our economy. And so there's a number of issues I'm going to look at. And the first, again, I'm just going to quote from Alexander Tyler. You might have heard this quote before, 1787. He's a Scottish history professor at the University of Edinburgh who said the following concerning the Athenian Republic some 2,000 years earlier. So this is a quote in 1787, speaking about what happened in the Athenian Empire Republic 2,000 years earlier, and you'd think that this was written in 2022. He says, "A democracy is always temporary in nature. It simply cannot exist as a permanent form of government. A democracy will continue to exist until the time that voters discover they can vote themselves generous gifts from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates who promise the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that every democracy will finally collapse due to loose fiscal policy, which is always followed by a dictatorship." And that is, unfortunately, the way things go, right? And so let's just look at some of the challenges that we face. And the reason I'm pointing these out is we've looked at the way God would want us to run our economy, and then let's look at how we actually, where we are at today, and just sort of say, okay, wow, this is a real mess. And again, it should tell us that if Christ is Lord over all, that Christians need to be involved in all of life. We can't just leave these things to the world. We need to be involved and we need to speak out on these issues in our vocations that God has put us in. First of all, crushing debt levels. Crushing debt levels. I'll give you a few statistics, and if you want some of these numbers, I can provide them to you. So basically, back in 2000, let's just go back to the year 2000. The global debt levels were about $100 trillion. $100 trillion. These are generally U.S. dollars I'm giving you. $100 trillion. Right before the financial crisis in 2008, those numbers were $160 trillion. So we had a 60% increase in 8 years. That was a large uptick in debt that took place before the financial crisis. This year, right now, they're about $300 trillion. $300 trillion. And that's on a basis of about 90, 95 trillion global GDP. So you're talking about 300% plus global GDP, debt to GDP. Now you think of the U.S. government. The U.S. government, which is very important because they're the world's largest economy. They also control the reserve currency of the world. The U.S. government debt, when Ronald Reagan took over, and they were very concerned about debt levels, this was October 1981, it crossed $1 trillion. 1981, 41 years ago. Today, the debt is now $30 trillion. $30 trillion. 30 times in 41 years. Now, for those of you who know how to work a calculator, you can do the annual compound rate of growth. So what was the annual rate of growth of debt in the last 41 years in the United States? Just under 9% per year. 8.65, to be exact. Then you look at the annual growth rate in the economy, so the annual GDP growth, and it was tracking at about 4.6%, so almost half. So you have debt growing at twice, almost twice the rate of growth of the underlying economy. Well, that's impossible to keep going. It's impossible. This is unsustainable. This is an immoral, decadent country that is on the edge, basically. Let's call it what it is. These are people. And you listen to the government in the United States right now, the federal government, and they don't even care about the deficits anymore. This discussion doesn't even come up anymore. Same thing in Canada. It's like, well, we've gotten away with it. We print the money. Don't worry about it. I mean, at least 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, people would start talking about we need a balanced budget. In Canada, we had a balanced budget just before Justin Trudeau took over. But that talk isn't even there anymore because we don't care. We just squander everything. Just a wasteful, immoral, decadent culture on every level. And so when you look at the Canadian situation, and just give you some sense of that, when you look at the Canadian situation, you have to include not just federal debt, but provincial debt, because in Canada, the provinces can run large deficits and accumulate large debts, which they cannot do in the United States in terms of the states. The states have to have infrastructure projects or collateral behind the debt that they run. So their debt, California, very small debt, even though it's a horribly run state. It's maybe $30-40 billion, but most of that it would be it'd be funded by infrastructure projects, at least if you believe that. But that's what they say. But in Ontario, we're in Ontario, and the Ontario government has a $400 billion debt. on a little over $800 billion economy, so that's about a 50% debt to GDP. Just in Ontario, it's one of the worst sub-sovereign states in the world. Okay, we're living here. Enjoy it, right? And when you think of the two big portfolios for the Ontario government, 70% plus of their costs, where do they go? Education and healthcare. Both are disasters. And I use the word disasters, that's being kind. And we have a $400 billion debt. If that's not gross incompetence and immorality in a province that's so wealthy in the past and so blessed, then I'm not sure what it is. And so when Doug Ford says, and not to pick on him, all the parties are equally to blame, so, but Doug Ford says he has your back, he doesn't have anyone's back, right? This is our money that they've squandered and they've wasted. The federal government, as we know, has a $1.2 trillion debt. That used to be $550 not that long ago, about 3 years ago. And under Justin Trudeau, we've seen that debt more than double in the last number of years, particularly with COVID. And so the thing that you have to realize is when debt to GDP gets above 80%, economies start to stagnate because the debt's just too overwhelming on the economy. It's too much of a tax on the economy, if you will. When you get over 100% debt to GDP, you basically start to get into a debt spiral. It's very hard to get out. And the only way you really get out is if you are going to, well, you could default. Inflation, which we're seeing now, deflates the value of the debt. But you need super growth. You need like really massive growth. And look at our leaders. They don't want any growth, right? They don't want any growth. They want us to basically starve. Literally, and I don't say that, that'd be a little bit of fun, but I mean, it's literally, these people don't want growth. I mean, we could sit around here this afternoon and come up with 10 ways we could grow the Canadian economy and put those into place, and it would be far better than anything you'd see coming out of Ottawa. And that would be, like, literally true. And so we see these problems. Another issue we have is unfunded liabilities. This is when governments promise things that they have no money for. Pay as you go. If you did this in your business, or if corporations did this and they said that for their employees that we're going to give you money in the future without setting aside the money, they'd be in jail. But not the government. The government's to say, just promise anything you want. Don't have to set aside the capital. Don't worry, it'll be there. Because we've got the Bank of Canada to print it for you, right? So unfunded liabilities. I won't bore you with all the details other than to say that if unfunded liabilities are massive, they're generally 2 to 3 times the size of the debts in the economy. In the United States, I mean, the United States is one of the worst situations. Canada's a little bit better in that area. The United States has unfunded liabilities, and the numbers are all over the place. But if you use conservative numbers, maybe $80 to $120 trillion. $80 to $120 trillion unfunded on an economy that's $23 trillion. Like, how does that work? You know? And they just keep promising more and more. It's like if you listen to Joe Biden in his more lucid moments, which are very few and far between, then you know you might get he'll just like, I'm going to spend more money. We're going to build back better, you know, build back better. They're destroying things, right? So unfunded liabilities. European pension systems, healthcare systems are completely unfunded, and they're in terrible shape. Then you look at the money that's been printed. We said before that the Bible has a lot to say about watering down money. In fact, it condemns countries. It condemns economies that print money. You see that in Isaiah 1:22 in particular, but you see it in a number of occasions. The prophets come and they say, you are printing money. You're diluting. You're adding dross to your silver, which is printing money. And they condemn it. This is a sign of immorality. Well, if you think about the U.S. situation, back in 2008, the U.S. had $800 billion in their base level of currency, base monetary unit, $800 billion in 2008. Today, it's $10 trillion, $10 trillion. They've added $9 trillion out of nowhere, fictitious money just put in the system to keep things going. And it's outrageous. I mean, when you look at these numbers, you can't believe it. Right, you really can't believe it. This is all supported by Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Stanford economists. Right, they have all their degrees to give you theories and why this is prudent and wise. Right, And then you look at the Canadian situation. Our base money in 2008 was $50 billion. $50 billion. $80 billion when Justin Trudeau took over, 2015. Currently, it's over $500 billion. And right before COVID, it was $110 billion. So we went from $110 billion prior to COVID to $510 billion. This is why there's the call to fire the Bank of Canada governor. Basically, he is not independent. He did exactly what the government told him to do. They're going to run deficits. They're going to sprinkle money everywhere. And it's going to be completely printed. Quantitative easing is the fancy term for it. And so that's what you see in Canada. But again, the point here in a Sunday school class is to say these are all indications of a rotten, corrupt system. This is like the gasping for air, if you will, of the system. This is sin multiplied to a high level. We're in Pride Month, and we see the exaltation of sexual immorality and so forth. Well, sexual immorality brings economic immorality. They're all linked. It's all sin, and so we see this alive and well here. And I won't go into the issue of suppressing interest rates. We've seen the suppression of interest rates, which has crushed savers, which again is rewarding debtors at the cost of savers. I think I mentioned last week in Europe at one point there was over $15 trillion U.S. of European and Japanese debt that was trading at negative interest rates, below zero. That means you buy something, you get less money back. And again, this is theft. When your money cannot hold value, number one, when it's being inflated away, that's theft. And when your money can't generate a rate of return because it's being put into the economy to grow, as our Lord talks about even in many of his parables, that's also immoral, as the system can't support positive return on cash that's being put into work in the economy. And so again, these are all examples of sinfulness. That's the whole point that I want to emphasize here. I said last week, I'll just give you a reminder there, government expenditures as a percentage of GDP, in other words, the total value of the economy. In Canada in 1960, government spending was 15% of GDP. In 2020, it's 52.5%. 15 to 52.5%. In France, it went from 22 to 62%. France is running, that's one of the largest states. Can you imagine 62% of your economy, or in Canada where 50% of our economy is basically controlled by the state? And you wonder why our standard of living has collapsed in this country for young people? It's literally collapsed. And I use the word collapse because that's what's happened. You used to be able to buy a home for 2-3 times income 20, 30 years ago. How is that working now? Maybe it's 4-5 times 2 incomes, right? That's what you call a collapse in the standard of living. And that's because of sinfulness. It's because of sinfulness. It's because of rejecting productivity, rejecting growth, rejecting family unit. It's supporting social welfare to the extent that is way beyond what we should be doing and so forth. So you see all that. The U.S., it was 28% up to 46% of the economy. So we've seen this massive increase. We've also seen, as you would expect, and I've already given you an indication of that, if you look at the universities, the places of learning, you just have to look, and I'll just mention a couple of theories that have come out of the universities that are completely immoral theories and yet have become very much understood as foundational to our economy. And some of you have heard of modern monetary theory, MMT they call it, modern monetary theory. And we won't go into a lot of details. Let me just summarize it, and hopefully I give it a fair summary. This is a theory that you can run any amount of deficits you want. And of course, we were living in this in Canada. I think Chrystia Freeland, our finance minister, who should be doing something else. I won't suggest exactly what, but something else. These people believe this. You can just run deficits, and you make it up by printing money. And if inflation starts, then we'll just tax to slow down the system. And so this is this micromanaging of the economy based upon the fact that you can just pull levers and create wealth just by putting money in certain areas. It's the most naive, foolish, silly, immoral theory you could come up with. And yet it's held fairly high esteem amongst many of our universities. And we're seeing the impact of this. We're seeing inflation now. To think that the government can micromanage and put money in different areas where there's excess capacity so that prices aren't going to get bid up and then pull it out and do this. Who believes that? When in all of the history of mankind has government been able to do something like that? Nor is that their role. That's the key thing from a Christian point of view. That's not the government's role. They're supposed to have a civil defense and protect our borders. And get out of everything else. So when we say, well, the government can do it, no, they shouldn't be doing it. That's up to us. That's us. That's what we're supposed to be doing. Then you look at universal basic income, where we're going to, again, provide everybody with a basic income. And right away, as Christians, we should say, that's immoral. Because first of all, they got to take the money from people who are productive to give it to some who aren't. Secondly, if you don't work, you don't eat. Isn't that what the Bible says? If you're a widow and you're an orphan and you need care, of course we help people. We help them to get them out of poverty so that they can work. You don't create a system that allows people not to work. So not only is it fundamentally wrong against the character of God, against who God has made us in his image, it's economically unsound also, because if you go against who God is and you go against who man is, it won't work. And, you know, you can tear it apart on a lot of different levels. We don't have the time to do that. But you need to, as you listen to these things, think about this. I think it's in second reading or something like that in Parliament. They really want to shove this thing through. Why? Because you become dependent on the state and not dependent on Christ and on God, looking to him for our salvation, looking to him for our rock, our solid point, so forth. So that's, again, some of these, I would call them just asinine economic theories spun out of a neo-pagan academic institutions, basically, if you want to bottom line it. Then woke corporations and corporate socialism, we see that everywhere. University graduates have hijacked corporations, and their socialist and communist ideologies have become part of the corporate agenda. And we see that. I mean, Disney is a great example of this. There's many other examples, Coca-Cola, the way they were doing some of their training and so forth, all these major companies. Now, part of the reason why companies are bending over to this, you know, wokeism and critical race theory is appeasement, because they're put under pressure, and so they don't want to hurt their market share in some cases, so appeasement will work. And so, again, we need to push back, just like the governor in Florida did and the people of Florida against Disney. We've got to, like Netflix too, they push back, you know, Netflix is starting to lose subscribers, and hopefully none of you are on Netflix. That's your own personal choice, of course, but I'll give you my bias, because the person that runs Netflix is committed against Christianity, and most of the shows that are unique on Netflix are evil, wicked shows, and that's what you're funding. You know, there's plenty of other ways you can handpick and get the shows if you want something, but anyway. Netflix, they lose 200,000 subscribers, and their market share is starting to go down. So all of a sudden, what do? Hey, all of a sudden, they're interested in maybe some conservative programs, and they're starting to change the way they do things. And the owner of Netflix told his employees, if you don't like that, then leave, because we have to have a broader audience. So you see, the market can move things around. We need to push back against some of these corporations. The other reasons why corporations, especially the big ones, are woke, and they like corporate socialism. You think, why would corporations like socialism? Well, it's okay if they're running little monopolies. If the corporations are in cahoots with the governments and the regulators, and they have the lobbyists on K Street in Washington and up here in Ottawa, then, of course, the companies love to have less competition so they can make more money. And so we see this, the amount of money that goes back and forth with the politicians, but that's bribes. That's distorting justice. That's wrong. That's immoral, right? And so we see this all around us, and we need to push back against that also. We also see globalism and the loss of the nation-state sovereignty, and this is increasing also. Politicians are increasingly selling out their own countries to the agenda of multinational corporations and also transnational organizations, like non-government organizations, and the United Nations, World Health Organization, certainly has been high profile the last little while, and that's a nasty, nasty place. Certainly the last thing they're concerned about is your health, right? I mean, we know that. I mean, that's evidence. I mean, come on. Especially Christians should know better. The International Monetary Fund, World Bank, World Economic Forum, all of these organizations are trying to subvert national sovereignty. But God ordained states. You know, we don't have the time to go into into this in detail, but nation states are created by God. The Bible supports nation states, not one world government. And Christians of all people, and Christians down through history, have supported strong national borders and protection against statism and certainly global government. Nations are ordained by God. And it's protection against global tyranny, and all the freedoms and democracies to be protected and safeguarded need to be local. Okay, so Christians believe in nation states. We promote nation states. And this is a bulwark to protect us from one world government. One world government means total tyranny. And Christians should know better than to push any kind of global agendas. And so this is very important also. The other thing is that democracies and decision-making should always be decentralized. Now, we should know this as Baptists, right? A Baptist of all people, we believe in church autonomy, don't we? Well, why do we believe that we should give our decision-making to Brussels, right? Or to Geneva, when you've got some of these characters, or some other place in the world, or Beijing, or whatever, right? Decision-making should be made as local as possible. It should not be thrown up into higher levels. That's why the United States, its constitution, you look at the Federalist Papers and the debate that went on there too, is this idea of keep power as much as possible to states and then to municipalities. Don't let it go to Washington. Don't let it go to Ottawa. Once it gets there, they're going to stomp all over you. And that's, now if it all goes to some global place, you can just imagine what would happen. And so Christians, again, should be very, very concerned about this. The next point I'll just mention, and I'm covering a bit material just to give you something to think about, is ESG and this whole issue of corporate and national governance. We're seeing this whole growth in what they call ESG. And ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance. I would say this is the new religion of the masses, and that's because it really, behind that is climate change. In a nutshell, let me just summarize, and I'll just go off my notes because I want to stay on track here in time. Basically, in a nutshell, humans are a cancer in the universe. Humans are the problem. We live in a limited and impoverished universe, and we cannot survive unless we destroy the family as created by God, reduce and eventually eliminate procreation, and worship the creation in a neo-pagan pantheism. That's what ESG is all about, if you were to bottom line it. Just cut through all of the, we're going to save the environment. All of these Darwinian atheists who believe the world popped into being out of some black hole all of a sudden want to save the world, right? They don't even know if it's going to be around tomorrow on their theory, on their basis, their worldview, which is just a chance, universe, matter, and motion worldview. And so some of the chief architects of this environmental social governance met recently at the World Economic Forum, as you know, and during a session called Global ESG for Global Resilience, you've got to love these terms, they decided to double down on their objective for a new global economic order that transcends national borders and replaces free market capitalism. And destroying free market capitalism in favor of the new stakeholder model. This is a stakeholder model. Sounds great, eh? Well, who are the stakeholders? Not you and I, that's for sure, right? And global elites hold all the power, and this has been their objective for centuries. This has been the objective going back to the Greek Empire, for pity's sakes. Going back in all of the empires of the world. This is the same desire to control the world. Alexander the Great. I mean, you can go back in history. That's why if you don't teach history, you're going to definitely repeat it. And if you live a pastless present, you'll fall for anything. And that's the situation we see in our own world. And so what they want to do is a single ESG system gets them much closer to this goal. It will be also very effective at eroding national sovereignty, circumventing democratic processes, coercing companies into compliance, and ultimately restricting individual choice, all in the name of saving the planet. We're going to save the planet. Everyone wants to save the planet, of course, right? Now, in order for the ESG disclosures to be meaningful, they've now set up a harmonized standard. This is what they're working on now. Just came out of their recent meetings. They call it the International Sustainability Standards Board. Isn't that wonderful? We just need another board, another standards that we're going to measure everything by. But this will be the standard that they're going to start to measure everything from. And you can imagine how that gets tightened up over time. Now, you can be sure that the framework they develop will, if implemented, result in the following. This is my predictions. And the deindustrialization of the global economy, which we're seeing now, that's because of the massive driving up of energy costs, trying to get off fossil fuels and onto alternatives way too fast and unnecessarily anyway, drive up all our energy costs. It'll reverse the enormous economic progress of the last 200 years. It will lead to mass starvation, depopulation, food production will drop, poverty and servitude of the masses, and ultimately tyranny and the persecution for the Christian church. That's what's really coming down the pipe. And this is all published. They all talk about this, so I'm not really predicting much. This is, of course, assuming that things move along according to their plan, and we look to the Lord ultimately and for his deliverance and for his help in all of these things. The Christian worldview will come under complete assault because that's the enemy. That's the enemy to all of this. The enemy to this is Christ. The enemy to this is the triune God. And the state will try to push a full orbed trans and post-humanism worldview, and that's what we're going to shift to, you know, in the next 2 weeks. You'll see how they're going to try to work this out. And so be careful, this whole ESG thing, this whole issue, it's a carbon scam is what it is. It's a complete carbon scam. It's got nothing to do with the environment. It's got everything to do with power. And if you want to look at the most dirty places on earth, the ones that need cleaning up, they're all run by totalitarian, overreaching governments, right? They're the dirty, filthy places in the world, not Canada. And that doesn't mean we can't do a better job and so forth, but we can do that quite well without the government getting on our back, especially international organizations. I was speaking yesterday at a conference at a church, and a person came up to me afterwards, and they said, you mentioned that ESG, and they said that we have a rental property, and I have a mortgage on this rental property, and in the paperwork that just came back to update the mortgage, they have this category called ESG, she said. I said, really? Isn't that interesting? And so they have to fill out what they're doing in the environment, social, and governance area with this rental property. And what's very interesting, because you know I'm in the securities market, so I see this firsthand, that banks, the big banks now, are going to be imposing on their clients, you want money from the bank, then you better kowtow to the ESG crowd. And if you don't, you don't get money. And they're shutting money off to certain industries, like the fossil fuel industry. So what does that mean? The cost of capital in that industry goes up. Also means, as Christians, we need to band together, provide capital for each other for doing businesses, and tell the banks to go pound sand, basically, right, to the extent that we can. But expect this is going to be all through their material, because you know the banks say by 2030 or 2035, we're going to be carbon neutral, which is a scam, right? But to do that, they're going to stomp on anybody that opposes them. And so this is what you see. And then just with the last little bit here, diversity, inclusion, and equity. I think you should put them in that order. Diversity, think of the first letters. Inclusion and equity. I saw Andre Schutten speak about this a couple weeks ago. That stands for DIE, right? And so instead of promoting the biblical teaching concerning impartiality, remember we looked at this earlier on, Christians should be impartial, not partiality. And instead of promoting a meritocracy, we see the advance of a true systemic racism and mediocrity through critical race theory and intersectionality now and throughout our whole economy. And these are Marxist ideologies, which we talked about before. And so we're supposed to hire based on training and competence, and we promote based upon merit, not gender identity. This is absurd, right? And I mean, the perfect example of this is Justin Trudeau. Okay, you know, he got in, unfortunately, he did go through a legitimate voting process. But look at his cabinet. If you look at that cabinet, I've said this before, gender ideology was what he used to select. And it's some of the most incompetent cabinet ministers we have had in the history of our country, if not the most incompetent. And you know exactly what I mean. In the States, the same thing with Joe Biden. The level of competence in the cabinetry, in the cabinet ministers in the United States is absolutely outrageous. Imagine Pete Buttigieg running around as a transportation guy. You know, he takes off with his boyfriend have a child somehow, and he just takes off and disappears. Meanwhile, the whole transport system in the United States is going down. They're wondering, where's Pete? You know, he's nowhere to be seen. Janet Yellen, the Secretary Treasurer, who used to be the head of the Federal Reserve, I told you before, a couple weeks ago, she was in hearings Senate or congressional hearings, and they asked her about Roe versus Wade, and she said, if they overturn Roe versus Wade, that's going to hurt the economy. Now, can you imagine? It's going to hurt the economy if you stop killing children? My goodness. I mean, this is the kind of level of intelligence we're at. I mean, the darkness and the blindness of our culture, that's what you have to see. You have to see just the sin. We would be the same way if we are on the other side of it. We didn't have the enlightenment of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But it's just dark. And so we stand against diversity, inclusion, and equity, and we stand for impartiality, for the best, those who merit. The Bible is clear about all these principles. And we don't go for equality of outcome. We go for equality of opportunity. Amen. You never want a society where everyone turns out to be the same. That's a repudiation of who God is, his sovereignty, his providence, and who we are as made in the image of God. And to do it, you have to have a complete tyrannous state. They replace God. And that's what they're trying to do. You have to understand that this is satanic. It's demonic. It's evil. Spiritual battle that we see around us. Then the last point I'll make is be very careful. I often hear about people, there's been this big shift in the investment industry to index funds, into exchange-traded funds. So people put more and more of their money into mutual funds that are just broadly based. What's the problem with that? What's the problem with that? The problem is there's about 5 or 6 companies that control all the index funds. So when you're buying these index funds, you can expect that probably the person running it is going to be Vanguard or BlackRock. And a lot of times people come up to me and they go, oh, Vanguard, BlackRock, these are terrible companies. They're buying up all the real estate. They're buying up property. They're World Economic Forum. Yeah, they are. But it's not their money. It's your money. You're giving them the money in their funds. And what they're doing is they now control the proxy voting system of corporate proxy voting system. So you've got 20%, 25% of corporations on the Fortune, the S&P 500 are controlled by BlackRock and Vanguard because they control the index funds, and that's where most of the money is. So if you don't want all your votes being cast in a way that's going to promote ESG, anti-capitalism, attacks on Christianity, and so forth, get your money out of places where you know that the stewards of those capital are going to vote against our Christian principles and ethics and morality. That's the bottom line. I could give you a lot of stats. I won't do that. And so as we finish up here, the good thing is that we have the scriptures. We have the Bible. We know the reality that Christ is on his throne. And so I don't say these things to be negative and puts you into a whoa, my goodness. It's like, get excited that these are the challenges that we face, but all of these challenges as a result of sin and leaving the way God would have us live in terms of his world. We need biblical wisdom. We need biblical wisdom. We got lots of knowledge in our world. I have a whole section here on intellectual capital. Our world talks about all this intellectual capital and know-how. But remember Enron? Some of you are older. Remember Enron? They wrote that book, The Smartest Guys in the Room, and they took down the whole company. Yeah, smart people. You can have lots of intellectual capital. But if you don't have wisdom, biblical wisdom, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, then you really have nothing. And we have that. So let me just finish by reading a quote from Bruce Waltke, who wrote the 2 volumes, the best volumes, I think, on Proverbs, the commentary. And he says this about biblical wisdom. He says, wisdom entails knowledge, insight, prudence, cunning, discretion, learning, and guidance. It includes counsel, understanding or competence, and resourcefulness, and heroic strength. All these virtues are packaged with the concept of wisdom. Wisdom equips one to rule, to show broad leadership, enables one to acquire wealth and subsequently manage it wisely. Most importantly, the concept of wisdom presupposes that all these capacities are exercised in the realms of righteousness, justice, and equity, which gives wisdom a moral dimension to be exercised in the public square at all levels of society and culture. And so we need wisdom at every level in our society and in our culture. That's why when I read Ecclesiastes 11, 1 to 6, you know what? We proceed on. We don't look at the cloud. You know, that passage here, it says, he who observes the wind will not sow. If we look at all the negatives, we're not going to sow. He who regards the clouds will not reap. We just go forging straight ahead, trust the Lord, do what we can do, and we pray and be involved in the work of the church and the work of the Lord, because ultimately only he can really change this. And it's a spiritual battle 120%, right? It's all a spiritual battle. And so if God is not enthroned in the hearts and minds of the citizenry, then the citizenry will enthrone the idol of the state in its place. And this can only lead to economic and spiritual poverty and political tyranny. And it's only biblical Christianity that has an answer. And we have that answer. We have the scriptures. So let's be those who are involved in every area of life and bring the gospel and bring Christianity and bring Christ as ruler over all into all areas of life. Okay, so let me just end in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you that indeed Christ is ruler of all kings. He is the one that stands above all. And that you are in control of all these things. We look at our world and we think, wow, what a mess. But we also realize that this is a result of sin. It's a result of turning from your word and your instruction. We pray that we would be faithful and that we would look to you, that we would, again, take out into the world these wonderful truths that you've given us in the scriptures and bring the gospel of Jesus Christ, which can change human hearts and human minds, so that they're conformed after the image of Christ and not after the things of this world. So, Father, be with us, guide and direct, help us indeed as we go forward into the world in which you have placed us at this point in history. We thank you that we can now look forward to the worship service and pray that you be with us as we ready our hearts and minds to worship you in spirit and truth and to also feast around the table at the end of the service and remember that this is all possible through the finished work of Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.